Well, hey there, podcast listener. How are you today? Like, really? Because if I could be honest, you're looking a little stressed out. And that's okay, because I've got your back. Because if you are feeling stressed out with life and work, left to feel unfulfilled, stuck, and ready for a new chapter to begin, well, I'm inviting you to change that. Because I want you to sit down with me and let's figure out a plan together, your life's roadmap, taking you from where you are right now and getting you to where you want to be. All you have to do is head on over to workwithkevin.coach. That is workwithkevin.coach to sign up. Until then, enjoy today's episode. Hey, what's up? It's Kevin, host of Grit, Grace, and Inspiration. Before you dive into today's episode, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Naked Warrior Recovery. If you've ever thought about trying CBD products before, well, here is your opportunity. Head on over to nw-recovery.com and use promo code LOW, that's L-O-W-E, all capital letters, to snag an extra 20% off. All of this information and links are inside of today's show notes. Enjoy the episode.
It was an energy drink called Rip It. I think they still sell it at Dollar Tree. But so I was drinking those, thinking I was going to give myself a heart attack by pulling an all-nighter doing these drawings. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, my sergeant says, Rich, can you drive your little pickup out to the airfield? We got some stuff for you to pick up. And the soldier comes walking out of the back of the plane saying, are you Mr. Rich? And I go, yeah. He goes, compliments of the colonel. And it was 3 cases of energy drinks.
Welcome to Grit, Grace, and Inspiration. I'm your host, Kevin Lowe, and I'm excited to welcome you inside. This is the kind of place where your glass will never be anything other than half full, because we choose to focus on the positive side of life. Now, this doesn't mean that we shy away from the real talk. No, not a chance. Matter of fact, we explore all aspects of life, from the good, the bad, and the ugly. But all of that is done with one purpose. To inspire you to never give up on life, even when it may seem like life has given up on you. Now, I get it. Life is hard, but starting today, you've got grit, grace, and inspiration. What's going on and how are you today? Oh man, hopefully nothing less than spectacular. Today's episode is coming out right after the conclusion of the Thanksgiving holiday. Hopefully you are feeling fat and happy. And if you're returning to normal life, well, welcome back to reality. But thankfully today we are back again after the Thanksgiving break, here to bring you another amazing conversation had with just another ordinary person, but with an anything but ordinary story. Today, I'm in the studio with Rich Walton. Rich, back in 2008, suffered the consequences of the 2008 recession. He was an architect in the Pacific Northwest, and he was faced with the dilemma, like so many people. What do I do? How do I feed my family? How do I provide an income? And so Rich would find himself doing something he never dreamed he would do before. And that was working in Afghanistan as a civilian contractor. The experience had while working in Afghanistan was something that has truly shaped Rich's life from that point forward. He had no clue what he was in for when he signed up for this assignment. And yet, he found great pleasure in doing his work, in being an architect, helping to rebuild Afghanistan, building schools, doing stuff for both the U.S. Army and Afghan Army. His story is truly incredible. It's really exciting, funny, kind of scary, but it all just equals out to be this incredible story time with Rich as we get to learn about what it was like to not only be an American in a foreign country, but to be working in a foreign country during wartime. Before I bring you that interview with Rich Walton, I do want to remind you, we are still being sponsored by Naked Warrior Recovery, a leader in the highest quality THC-free CBD products on the market. If you would like a little extra help with both your physical and mental health, well, be sure to check out Naked Warrior Recovery today, and you get to save an extra 20% because you are a listener of this podcast. Head on over to nw-recovery.com, link is in the show notes, and use promo code LOW, that's L-O-W-E, my last name, to save 20% off on your order. With that said, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Rich Walton as we catch up on his incredible story of working in Afghanistan as a private contractor. Rich, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to my story and to find out about what's going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. Well, Rich, I want to dive right into your story and we can kind of, you know, go back and forth and fill in the gaps and such. But right off the bat, I have to ask the most kind of obvious question in my mind is, what compelled you to go to Afghanistan?
Well, it was back in 2008. That, if you kind of remember that, that was when we had a recession. And at that time, I had my own architectural design business, and I had about 10 guys and girls working for me at the time, mostly doing residential architecture, but every once in a while, a small motel or a little building like that out here in the Pacific Northwest. And so when that recession started, I always kid people that, you know, I talk to about it. I says, it's a recession when your neighbor's out of work. It's a depression when you're out of work. I'd had my business for over 30 years, you know. And actually had my middle son working for me, who had just graduated from Portland State College here in Portland area. And all of a sudden, all of my contractors started going broke. Some of them decided it was a time for them to get out and retire. And so the amount of work available just started dwindling really fast just before my eyes. And I'd lived through the recession in 1980, which goes back a ways. And my wife and I said, well, we'll just stick it out and, you know, come out the other side just like we did in 1980. Well, this time in 2008, it was much more extreme. And so as things got less and less and less, my wife was a stay-at-home mom. You know, we had to try to do something. And so I started trying to pick up side jobs, going to Costco and all these other places, just trying to keep my business going as I gradually laid off people. And when I finally had to lay off my son, that's when it really just kind of got me down and out, just kind of kicked me in the teeth. And we just said, we have to do something at that time. So my wife happened to have a friend of hers that was back east on the East Coast who had a contracting business in Iraq. And so I thought, well, I'll talk to him. I have done work where I've sent my drawings through AutoCAD over the internet to Thailand and had them work on it. And they'd send it back to me, you know, and I thought that was cool and everything. So we went back there to talk to this gentleman about me doing architectural work for him, but I had no idea that his idea of me working for him was to actually be boots on the ground over there in that part of the world. So that's how the whole thing started to evolve on that. It was nothing that I ever planned or thought about. I never thought about going to Afghanistan. You know, I'd seen it on the news since, you know, 9/11. But really hadn't paid a whole lot of attention from it, just from just what I'd seen on the newscast. And never being in the military, this was, you know, completely out of character for me to do something like this. But, you know, times got desperate, and make it short, I, all of a sudden after meeting with him, he looked over at my wife when we were back there, and he went over and says, is that your wife? And I said, yes. And so he walked over to her and said, would you mind if your husband went to Afghanistan? And she goes, no, sure, go right ahead. So that's how it all began. He said, well, let me get back to you. And within a few weeks, I got an email, early in the morning here, because he's on the East Coast. Of course, I'm here on the West Coast. And it said, okay, you're hired. You got 2 weeks to close down your business and get on a plane and head for Baghdad. And I came in, woke my wife up and said, I got the job, but look at this. I only have 2 weeks. And I had no idea what to do, how to do it. Do I need shots? Do I need medical? You know, what clothes do I take? You know, how do I even prepare for this? Contacted him back and I said, what actually is my job over there? And he says, I don't know. You'll make it up as we go along. Okay. And so with $300 in my pocket and a plane ticket to Baghdad, because that's where their headquarters were at the time, I hopped on a plane and headed for the Middle East all by myself with no clue of what I was going to do. So that's kind of how it all started.
Wow. I mean, it's exhilarating. It's exciting. It's something that you do, but were you scared at the same time?
Sure. I mean, when I got to Atlanta, Georgia, it was a direct flight from Portland to Atlanta. I was sitting there and all of a sudden going, what am I doing? And so I called my wife and I says, is this something we really want to be doing? And she goes, well, others have done it. And if you don't like it, then just come home. But I said, but it's a war zone. You know, it's not like I'm going to LA New York or something, you know? And yeah, it was totally tough. I was nervous. I had no idea. I had the advantage of I have three sons and all three of them were in the military. Two at the time were still in. One was in the Navy and one was in the U.S. Army. So they kind of gave me some advice on what clothes and stuff to wear. But yeah, I was totally, didn't know, what was going on. And so especially when I landed in Dubai and looked around and knew nobody, I'm just going like, whoa, man, am I out of my element here? You know, and I had to find my own way to a hotel. And so the adventure just started from that point on where I just had to make it up as I went along.
Wow, that's insane. Now, so in the capacity that you went to Afghanistan, so working as a civilian contractor, so was this though, being an architect, you were still going to be like working with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan?
Well, Kevin, that's what I kind of thought. But their idea of working with the Army was different than mine. I had friends of mine, of course, obviously, that had gone to Afghanistan and Iraq and lived on these big military bases, right? Well, when I showed up at the airport in Afghanistan, I had an Afghan general there meet me with two Lebanese bodyguards that soon became my personal security. And we hopped in a car and drove to a house. It had like about an 8-foot concrete little wall around it. And it had a nice little grass yard that was probably like 10 by 20, you know. I said, where's the base? And they go, oh, that's down way down the road. This is where you're going to be living. And I said, are you kidding me? And these two Lebanese guys, they handed me, when we got in the car, handed me a bulletproof vest to put on, which I had no idea how to put it on. And I'd been in Iraq, a couple weeks before, so I'd had kind of a little minor exposure to this. But this was nothing that I totally was going to be, expecting, And so when I emailed home, I said, well, I'm not on a military base. I'm actually living in a house where they have no street signs. They have no identification on the outside or anything like that. So, and then the two Christian Lebanese, the reason I mentioned Christian Lebanese, because they have both Christian and Muslims in Lebanon, but they were my security detail. And that was it.
Wow. That is just totally insane. So talk to me then about, from that point forward, what kind of give me like broad spectrum, what you started doing. And then, there's so many questions about just how this whole experience happened. But I guess let me preface all of this by asking, what year was this, and what was the status of like the war in Afghanistan going on at this point?
This was 2008, so stuff was going, you know, full-blown, you know, on that time. You know, the war was, you know, all around us. I could hear rockets and mortars going off all throughout the city. The Taliban at the time were driving around the city in these little pickups, you know, shooting their rockets and their guns at different buildings. You know, I covered quite a bit of this stuff in my book, but, you know, I had where my Lebanese guys would say, I'd hear an explosion, and I'd go, what was that? And they said, well, it was a mortar, or it was a, you know, a grenade, or different things like that. And I was just totally dumbfounded by, you know, and I guess shell-shocked about what was going on. I had a cleaning lady and a cook that came to the house every day that helped prepare meals and clean up, but they didn't speak English. And of course, I didn't speak the two major languages over in Afghanistan, are Pashto and Dari. So everything I had was just from what the Lebanese were kind of training me. And of course, you know, I was like a fish out of water, where they said, you have no military. And I said, no experience. No, I have none of that. And so it was just like from day one, how do I do this? You know, I had my company back in Baghdad that was kind of giving me direction. But basically what I did was I would try to bid on contracts that the U.S. government was issuing, and I would meet with the local Afghan contractors to try to get them to get me prices so that we could come up with a bid to, say, like build a school or a road or a building or something like that.
Wow, that's very interesting. So now, what was the mission that you were there to do? Was it any type of infrastructure they're wanting you to work on building? You know, what was the details for that?
Typically, Kevin, a majority of it was where I would search the websites with the Army Corps of Engineers at the time was spearheading a lot of the construction over there that I would be bidding on. So I would look online and see projects that were in, you know, maybe, you know, smaller ones that were in our ability to do. So it would be like working on military bases. It would be working out in the local area. But that's where the real difficulty came in, because there is no phone book over there. There is no way to know who, you know, supplies concrete, who supplies wood, who supplies different materials. So I actually had to have my Lebanese drive me around the city and just start knocking on doors going, it looks like you're a concrete plant. You know, how much do you sell your concrete for? And do you go to these areas?
Wow.
That's the other thing you had to keep in mind, is that I was in the city capital of Kabul at the time. And for all state purposes, that was probably, you know, one of the safer places to be. Well, some of these projects were out in other areas where the people in Kabul would not even go, you know, where they were controlled, you know, mostly yes, by the Taliban, and the risk was there. And that's when I really started to learn that Afghanistan was a tribal society. And so you would have different people from different tribes saying, I'm not going down to that area because my tribe isn't down there. And so this whole scenario of Afghanistan being a unified country, I realized it was more of a, you know, a tribal society with everybody, the different tribes trying to get along the best they can, but realizing that each one had their own agenda on what was, you know, they wanted out of the whole scenario. So, and I would meet with the different contractors. They would come to my house and, you know, talk to me about different things. And I had one of my contractors, Afghan contractors, one of the first days there, he was a educated gentleman. He graduated from the university there. And he told me, Mr. Rich, because that's what I went by. A lot of the people there only have one name. And maybe we'll get into this a little bit more, but I used to tell people that I felt I was back in biblical times. And so my first name is Rich, my last name is Walton. So they all began calling me Mr. Rich. And then, of course, since I was from America, they just assumed that I was rich. So it all kind of played into each other, you know, that, you know, this is Mr. Rich. And he told me, he says, there's four things I want you to remember. He says, you know, even me, he says, Afghans will lie to you, cheat you, try to steal from you, and possibly try to kill you. He says, you base all your decisions upon those four things, and you should do okay in Afghanistan. And of course, I'm just sitting there with my mouth open, you know, this is what I have to deal with now. And so,
yes.
And then the other thing he always said was, do you have enough guns? I go, what? He said, do you have enough guns? Because if you don't have enough guns, we'll bring you some more guns. And I thought, wow, this is nothing that I would have in a general business meeting in, you know, in the United States. it was just one, you know, shock after another.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you when you talk about, you know, here you are, this American over there trying to organize job sites and working with, you know, concrete plants and stuff. What was the interaction you had? How were you treated? Was it a welcoming thing to work with you or not when you're, you know, approaching these, you know, companies and people there in Afghanistan?
They were really welcoming. Of course, you know, they wanted, you know, to get the job and get paid on something like that. But no, they were all real helpful to me. Going back to those four basic principles, though, I had one day where I had several contractors come to meet with me, and they handed me, of course, their brochure. And I realized that after two of them, it was exactly the same brochure with the same photos, of the same equipment, everything exactly the same, except just the title on the brochure was their company name. And so when the third contractor showed up and handed me the same exact brochure, I pulled out the other two and I go, well, I've already got these two. And I said, yours is exactly the same, you know, Hamid, with just a different name on it. And he goes, oh, no, Mr. Rich, mine is the real one, you know. And so I began to realize, you know, that, you know, things are done a little bit differently over there. But as far as meeting with all the people, they were all real cordial, friendly, kind. You just had to learn that the way that they were doing things. And that was the biggest thing, Kevin, for me, was this huge, huge cultural and religious learning curve that, you know, I had no preparation for, had no courses that I took on to it. Of course, I had courses in architecture that helped me out down the road tremendously. That was about Alexander the Great and his influence and everything over in Afghanistan and the Brits and the Germans and the Russians and the Persians and all that type of thing that I had to study in architecture school. But it was just a complete, you know, eye-opening for this type of thing that was going on and how business was done. But yeah, to answer your questions, they were great to deal with. You just had to be cautious of what they did. And I actually had one businessman tell me, Mr. Rich, it's your responsibility to decide if I'm lying to you or not. It's not my fault. It's your fault if you don't figure that out. And I went, whoa.
Wow.
That's not generally how I do business in America. But, you know, that was another wake up call.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. So speak to me a little bit more about what you kind of preference about some of these cultural differences and how that impacted just not only doing business, you know, trying to do your job there, but just living.
Well, one of the first things that happened, it was the second night I was there, I had an Afghan general show up there who soon became, you know, good friends with me. But at the time, he was just talking to me about working with me on helping find, you know, contractors. Because how do I find contractors over there? You know, I had to find somebody that was, you know, fairly well reliable that I could talk to. And I was sitting there with my legs crossed and the bottom of my foot pointing towards him. And my two Christian Lebanese guys kept pointing at me, you know, kind of erratically, like, what's with your foot, you know? And so finally they came over and said, put your foot down. You're being really impolite by pointing the sole of your foot at the general. And I went, oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know that, you know? So yeah, that was kind of a first reaction. The next day, I had an Afghan show up, and he told me that the company I was working for owed him $35,000 because the guy that was in the position before me had never paid him. So that became a real, you know, exciting moment when he's, you know, was demanding the money, and I had no idea. And so he said, basically, you know, I want this money by the end of the week or else. And so as I walked in the gate, I looked out in the street and here was probably about 50 Afghans, all with AK-47 rifles and stuff that were part of his bodyguard contingency out there. And so to make a long story short, we ended up, you know, getting him the money and that was all, you know, taken care of. But, you know, just everything that is different over there that you can imagine. I felt very fortunate that I came out the other end of it because certainly things could have went sideways on a lot of situations over there.
Yeah, absolutely. How long did you end up staying over there for?
Okay, for this first time over there, I was over there for about 3.5-4 months. And that was living in the house there.
Okay.
And one of the first things I realized was when we would go out to different job sites, we would ride out in a car. And I would see military all around me out on the streets of Kabul, you know, in the big militarized vehicles with armor and stuff like that. And we're driving around in a little car. And so they said, well, we need to make you fit in, so you need to grow a beard. And I said, oh, okay, but, you know, my skin's kind of, you know, light complected. I'm from Scandinavian descent. My grandfather immigrated from Sweden, and I have blue eyes. And all of a sudden, I remembered from my architectural studies that there was a group in northern Afghanistan in a place called Nuristan that were descendants of Alexander the Great. And I mentioned to them, I said, is there still that group up there? And they said, yes. And they look just like you. So a lot of times they would dress me up in the different kinds of outfits that they would wear up there in Nuristan. And they would try to pass me off as a Nuristani. They'd say, just don't talk, as we drove down through different parts of traffic and would be challenged by the police. You know, and they'd want to look in the car and they'd see me sitting in the back seat, because kidnapping was a huge issue during those times also, you know, where they'd kidnap you and want ransom money. And it didn't matter if they were police or not. But so then I became, you know, Mr. Rich, the Nuristani. But what really impacted me a lot was I had a couple of people that, you know, my cook and my cleaning lady that lived in the, or came to the house to work with me. And that's where I really began to realize what the culture was about with those different individuals, and realizing that I was told 80% of the people in Afghanistan can't read or write. So there became the other challenging issue, especially when I got out to job sites with the workers and stuff. You know, how do you explain to somebody how to do something, let alone in a different language, if they cannot read or write?
Mm. It's almost like truly going back in time.
It was. And that's what I would tell people. And one time they thought my bodyguards thought I'd been in the sun too long, because I started laughing. And I go, it is just like biblical times. I says, all these different people I'm meeting with have one name. They don't know what day they were born on. They don't know how old they are. I mean, kind of approximately. And I said, in the Bible, nobody has a last name. And that's what I was laughing about. So there's David, Saul, and, you know, all the different people in the Bible, Moses, none of them have last names. So then I started laughing to myself. I am back in biblical times, especially when you get out of the capital city, you know. There's nomads running all around out there with their sheep and their goat herds, you know, just like 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And once you left the big cities, yes. And later on, I ended up staying in bases and villages that were underneath the shadow of some of Alexander the Great's castles that were built in 300 BC, still standing there.
Wow. Wow. How fascinating. How fascinating. So you said that this first time that you were there, you're only there for roughly like 4 months and so. So right. You would end up, though, going back more times.
Yeah. Well, I ended up going back a final time for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
That was a different kind of situation there with that, in that I came home and tried to get my business going again. And, you know, it was still recession type of times. And so then another opportunity came up for me to go back, this time working for the U.S. government. So I kind of flipped to the other side, where before I was the contractor out trying to do the work. And this time now I was the overseer with the U.S. government, overseeing the projects that were being done to make sure that, you know, things were being built the way they were. And of course, in Afghanistan, that's a whole thing in itself, you know. So then yes. I went back for the next 4 years, and I spent 2 years working with the U.S. Air Force in their engineering department, which was called the 577th, and their nickname for it is Prime Beef. And then I spent the next 2 years with what was my dream job. I would still be doing it today if they needed me over there. It was called the PRT, and it was called the Provincial Reconstruction Team. And that's where I really got out into the villages and the locals, and got to, you know, really interact with them much more than I did when I was, you know, attached to a regular military Air Force unit. So I spent 2 years doing that, where actually, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but when I joined them, I ended up traveling all around Afghanistan, basically with a backpack and a sleeping bag, and hopscotching all around wow. the country, working on projects. And it was just awesome, you know.
Yeah. Now, tell me, I'm curious, why why was that so appealing and so memorable for you?
I think because I felt like I was making a difference. I had basically kind of two missions, Kevin, with that. When I worked for both those organizations, both with the Air Force and with the PRT, I helped with building U.S. facilities and buildings, you know, like small camps, tents, small buildings, that type of thing. And then also on the reverse side of it, I was out actually building schools. And you got to keep in mind that a school for them might be, you know, 25 feet by 50 feet, you know, because it's in a village made of brick. I mean, it could have several functions, but for them it was a school. And I had the opportunity to build a few girls' schools, which in Afghanistan with the Taliban, they did not want girls educated over the age of 8 years old. And so that became, you know, really important to me to be able to do those. And then one of my final projects over there, kind of leapfrogging way ahead, is that I got to work on the University of Herat, which is over on the Iranian border, women's dorm, which was a huge facility over there for allowing girls to be able to go to college and stay there locally in a safe environment. Now, I don't know today if those are even being used or been repurposed for something else with, you know, with the political situation over there now. But at that time, even in the Herat, my interpreters told me that there was a $500 bounty on me for, you know, anybody building girls' schools. And so I kind of laughed at that amount of money.
Wow.
But yeah, so,
yeah.
And then, you know, I couldn't have planned anything that I did over there, Kevin. It was probably the most unpredictable experience I ever had, and an adventure that was like a movie, an ongoing movie. I had one time where I was sitting in my little office, and this is when I was working with the Air Force, and a colonel came in. He says, "Do you know how to draw some drawings? Anybody in here know how to draw drawings?" And the sergeant at the front door said, "Yeah, old Mr. Richard's back there." And at that time, I was 58. And so I had this gray beard. And okay. He comes back there and he goes, "I hear you can draw." And I go, "Yeah, I can draw." I said, "Let me send it up to the headquarters, you know, for the engineers and architects to do it." Because I was basically doing construction management at the time. And he says, "No, I need it right now."
Okay.
And I said, "We just had a base overrun. Outpost, and we got to get the stuff up there and refortify and put the buildings back up and everything like that." And I said, "Okay, what do you need?" He says, "Four buildings." And I said, "Okay, I can draw those up on AutoCAD and, you know, get you copies of it." And I said, "When would you like it by?" And he goes, "Tomorrow." I go, "Four buildings by tomorrow?" Now, granted, they were simple buildings. They're wood-structured buildings. He says, "But I have to have all the material not be over 8 feet in length because we have to put it on the helicopters and fly it up there on top of the mountain to construct everything." And I said, "Well, Colonel, I'll give it my best shot." So at that time, I was drinking coffee, and they had, for any of your listeners that have been deployed, it was an energy drink called Rip It. I think they still sell it at Dollar Tree or General Store. It's a horrible energy drink. But so I was drinking those thinking I was going to give myself a heart attack by pulling an all-nighter doing these drawings. And so the next day he comes in, and I'm just, you know, literally, if you stuck my hands out, it looked like I was playing the piano. They were shaking so bad from being up all night long. And he says, "Oh, awesome. I got it. Okay, we'll go." And I said, "But unfortunately, I burnt through all my energy drinks, you know." And he says, "Oh, that's too bad." You know, and he left. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, my sergeant says, "Rich, can you drive your little pickup out to the airfield? We got some stuff for you to pick up." And so just like right out of the movies, here comes this big giant C-130 with the four engines, you know, coming down, landing. And I walk out there and the tailgate drops down. And the soldier comes walking out of the back of the plane saying, "Are you Mr. Rich?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Compliments of the colonel." And it was three cases of energy drinks. so I don't know where they came from or where, you know, how that worked out, but I just thought, wow, this is I can't make this stuff up, you know. And so when I drove back to my little office, my tents on this base, the particular one we were on, you know, the sergeant and a couple of the military guys were rolling over laughing because they knew what was up, and they saw that I had these energy drinks and everything like that. But so that's the way it worked.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is too funny, but. But how cool, and I guess what's kind of neat about it when you think about the irony of the situation is here you are, you're over in this country, this Afghanistan, this you know, almost beyond third world country and war zone on a, you know, army base, yet here you are, you know, you can still have some humor, still this relationship among, you know, coworkers and generals and stuff, you know, of doing something like that is that's just pretty cool.
Yeah. Going back to when I lived in Kabul, the lady that was my cleaning lady there, she didn't speak any English. And of course, her husband was killed by the Taliban, and she had to come to our house in her burqa. You know, those are those all blue, you know, outfits they wear, so you can't see anybody and see who they are.
Yes.
You know, she was not supposed to be working, but how was she going to, you know, feed her family without working? So she would come and clean up. And so here's a typical naivety on my part. So I happened to be at a base, and I went into the store and I found this cleaning brush, you know, and I thought, well, hey, this would be great for her to be able to clean, you know, my toilets and different things like that, right? And so I gave her the brush, and I had my interpreter. In that house, there was the two Christian bodyguards, Lebanese bodyguards, and then I had an interpreter that was a young gentleman that would live with me during the week, and then on the weekend, he would go home to be with his family. But, you know, he went everywhere with me to, you know, be able to interpret for me. So I thought, okay, explain to her that this is a cleaning brush for the toilet. Well, so he did. So one day, and I was always sick over there, Kevin, for a long time. My wife was sending me cases of Imodium. I mean, I was, you know, had all kinds of dysentery and diarrhea and stuff like that, just from, you know, the water and the food and different things like that. And so I come by the bathroom. And here's Ermina cleaning, and she's just humming and singing to herself. And I kind of watched her, and she took the cleaning brush and she wished it around in the toilet and did that. And I go, oh, good. She kind of got the idea what it was like. Well, without rinsing it out, she went over and she cleaned the mirror. And then she went over to the cup that had my toothbrush in it. Yes. And she pulled out my toothbrush and cleaned out the cup, and then carefully took the brush and cleaned off my Brussels on my toothbrush. I thought, wow, you know, there's a little bit of a cultural gap here. And so, you know, I couldn't get upset. You know, when I went and told my interpreter and my bodyguard, they were like upset. Well, we're going to, you know, when I said, no, I said, she doesn't know, you know, it's my fault for not understanding,
yes.
You know, what is common knowledge and common sense to us in America is foreign to them. And if I can just tell you one other quick little story about the cook, I saw him in there one day scrubbing the floor with his rag. I came back a little bit later, and he had that same rag sitting on top of the rice pot because we ate a lot of rice there. And the idea was that when the steam came up off the rice, you know, the lid on the rice pot would rattle. So he put this rag on there to kind of, you know, muffle it. And so I got my interpreter and told him, I said, you need to tell him that, you know, you can't just put the dirty rag on top of the rice because all that stuff goes down into the rice and I eat it. And I'm not like them. I don't have quite the antibodies that they have, and I get sick. And so they all agreed that they understood what it was. The next day, Kevin, I'm sitting at my dining room table there, and I'm eating this rice, and it tastes off to me. It tastes kind of funny. And I go, it tastes like bleach. And so I go back into the kitchen, and the cook looks up at me, and they're all excited. And I said, Safi, what's going on with the rag? And he goes, oh, no problem, Mr. Rich. You know, he spoke a little English, clean rag. And so he takes the rag off the pot and he goes over to the sink. And we had some bleach that I bought again at a U.S. military base, poured it over the rag, rinsed it, kind of wrung it out in the sink, and then put it back on top of the rice pot. So when the steam was coming up, all this bleach was dripping down into my rice. And I told my interpreter, I says, you need to tell him that, you know, he's going to kill me before the Taliban do. But there again, you know, things that we would just take for granted, it was just like, it was a huge learning curve for me. And you had to look at it, you know, being friendly and kind and that type of thing. And these people, a lot of them weren't used to that.
Yeah.
They were used to people just yelling and screaming at them and that type of thing, which I found out, you know. And so I was kind of like different, you know, for them.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't help but just sit there and think, oh, poor Mr. Rich. He thinks he's having stomach problems from the food. No, it's because he's brushing his teeth with a toothbrush. It's just been clean from the toilet, you know?
Exactly. And you got to remember that the homes and the villages where they were coming from, there's no running water. There's no electricity. There's no indoor plumbing. And so to be thrown into an environment with all these different amenities, it's like, well, how does all this work?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Now, we've talked about the Taliban. Did you have any situations like you that, you know, I would say were scary, any close encounters with the Taliban?
Yeah, I did. I can give you a couple examples. We'll go back to the house in Kabul. That's where they first came about. And that's where I first started wondering, what am I doing here? And one day I was laying in bed and a rocket was shot from the Taliban right behind my head by a window that was in my bedroom and hit the house next door and blew it up. And my two Lebanese guys that had bedrooms right next to mine came running in there and said, "Are you all right? You all right?" And I stood up on my bed and I just like, "What's going on? What's going on?" Well, we had talked about our different religions and stuff. I happen to be a Christian. And so we kind of had a bond there of talking about, you know, the difference between their Christian faith in Lebanon and mine in America and whatever. And they said, "You know, what's going on?" And they said, "Well, what's happening here?" And so when we'd sometimes have other Lebanese come over there, like spend a lot of Lebanese over there doing security details. And they go, "Oh, brave Mr. Rich. He was sitting there, 'Jesus, please help me. Jesus, please help me,' sitting on the end of his bed when the rocket hit the house next door and blew it up." And they thought it was all funny. Now, the thing you got to keep in mind is for these different individuals, they're both probably in their 40s, but they've been fighting the war in Syria since they've been 10 years old. And so, you know, it was a whole different lifestyle of them growing up, you know, than us here in America type of situation and what the horrors of war that they've been seeing since that age. One day I was out talking with this general that was kind of helping me with security, because whenever I'd go out to the house, I had to have a security detail with me, because it's just not like in America where you drop in a car and you take off and go. You got to see what the threat assessment is, what's going on out there, is there a chance of attacks, these type of things, where are the bombs being placed, on what roads, and this things that I was just totally like, "Are you kidding me?" And so he was sitting there telling me how safe I was. At that point in time, a car bomb went off just on the street outside of our little house that we had. And the shock wave came over the wall, hit me, knocked me down. And I remember kind of looking and seeing like the ground almost like rolling. And the shockwave went and blew all the windows inside the glass inside my house. And then just like out of one of those movies where you see the atomic bomb aftershock where it kind of goes the other direction, it sucked the two doors off our house into the front yard. And I looked up and it looked like a little atomic bomb going off with the mushroom cloud. And later I found out that there was like 17 people killed and 92 injured. And as I got up, and the general got up, I kind of brushed myself up and he looked at me and goes, "What, Mr. Rich? We're still alive, aren't we?" And at that point, I realized, you know, I had no control over what happened in my life over here. You know, and that's when I had kind of a real awakening of like what it's like to live over there. A couple of weeks later, we had to go out to this place, and you might have seen it in the news. It was called Bagram Air Force Base. It was about a 2.5-hour drive from where we were at. And I had to meet with a contracting officer out there for the U.S. And they asked me, "Mr. Rich, what day do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, let's go Wednesday," not thinking anything about it, right? And so Tuesday, there was a car bomb going off on that road out there and killed 5 people. Wednesday, we drove by that exploded area and saw the remains of the cars and everything else out there. Came back. Next day, on Thursday, the same thing happened again. And my Christian bodyguards come up to me, Lebanese, and they said, "Mr. Rich, you picked a very good day to go out to Bagram." And so after that, we kind of had this little joke going amongst us. And this is where, you know, you start to get a little weird sense of humor. Is I'd ask him, I said, "Okay," next time I asked him, I said, "We're going out to this place. How dangerous is it?" And they said, "Mr. Rich, I think we're going to see Jesus today." And I said, "Well, I don't mind seeing Jesus, but I just should not be today." So that became kind of the meter on how bad a place I was going, is if they would make that comment to me about, you know, we might not be coming back and we were probably going to see Jesus. So
yes,
it's just amazing that how all this stuff evolved.
Absolutely. Now, since you have been there, and obviously we've had, you know, crazy things with pulling out of Afghanistan and such, do you know how it is, what it's like there now?
Just from what I see on the news. And then I do have a few interpreters and people that I work with still there. I had, you know, several of them that were asking, you know, to help get their families out of, you know, Afghanistan. And so they email me. I'm surprised that, you know, sometimes I wonder if the emails are true or not, but it seems to be from them asking for aid and help and that type of thing. One, I just found out that the French helped get his family out of the country, and but he's still there. So, you know, it has changed. I heard they closed down the girls' schools and supposedly they're supposed to open them back up. But, you know, for a lot of these people, it had to be unbelievable, because if you think about it, we were there for 20 years. And so a lot of these people, like the kids on some of the basic stuff, started out at 10 years old working on a base, maybe picking up garbage, maybe doing different things like that, and then got educated and worked their way up to, you know, having a fulfilling job on the base over a 20-year period. So that's all they knew. And then all of a sudden, when we all leave, what happens to all those people, and what jobs do they then go to try to find to support their family?
Exactly.
Yeah, to answer your question, I have communication with a few people there. I have a communication. Most of my interpreters were able to get out, and they're, you know, like in places like Texas and Sacramento and back in Virginia. And so I can communicate with them, you know, on what's going on. But overall, I really don't know much more than what, you know, you and everybody else sees on the news.
Yeah. For those, if you don't mind me asking, for those who you know, who the interpreters who came to the States, how has that been for them? I mean, it's a big transition. I mean, talking about you going there to Afghanistan, equally, I mean, is dramatic for somebody who's lived there all their life to then come to America.
Yeah, you know, all of them had some kind of formal education, you know, university education. So they came from, like, you know, one of the three major cities, like Kabul, Kandahar, or Herat. So they're, you know, kind of knowledgeable, and they work with the different engineers from the Army and the Air Force and different groups like that, and like with people like myself. So we would talk about things. One of the things I got a kick out of, though, is over there we have pallets of bottled water everywhere, right? Because it's so hot and you don't know, you can't drink the local water. Well, I had to explain to them how much a bottle of water costs in the United States, because they're used to just grabbing it off the pallet for free, you know? And I go, it could be $3 or $4. Yes. They go, what? Are you kidding me? And at that time, the exchange rate was 50-1 for Afghanistan over there.
Yes.
Kind of sidetracked that a little bit. I had one Afghan general one time try to sell me a money printing press for $10,000, because he said that I could print my own Afghan money. And he thought, what a wonderful thing that would be. And I said, no, Mr. Rich doesn't need to be making counterfeit money. He goes, well, no, it's not counterfeit. It's the same machine they use for making the regular money. And I go, no, I think I'll pass on that. So, I mean, there's hundreds of stories like that, Kevin, where I would just sit there and go, I can't make this stuff up. This should be in a movie, you know? And it's like, so that was, you know, some of the things that happened with that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So now, at what point did you decide to write a book about, because your book is about this entire experience, correct?
Yes. And so what I started realizing was, you know, just watching the movies on TV and the different things like that, that, you know, most of people's idea of people going to Afghanistan was either the military or they were the private security details, like Blackwater and these different types of people like that, that, you know, ran protection for people. But nobody ever really talked about all the other contractors that went over there that helped with, you know, everything from medical to construction to business to, you know, help educate, just all kinds of other aspects of the contractors that were over there helping out. And so I decided I wanted to explain to my friends and relatives, because they'd always ask me, though, what was it like over there? What, you know, were you scared? Were you in danger? You know, and I kept repeating the stories over and over again. And when I came back from Afghanistan, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't want to do architecture anymore. I kind of lost the taste for that after, you know, having closed down and lose my business. And so at that point in time, I got a call to go operate some projects over in Kazakhstan, which is north of Afghanistan, along the Russian border. And it was just building little bases and different things like that up there. And there would be times where I'd be stuck out in the desert by myself for, like, you know, a couple weeks, you know, or whatever, and with nothing to do. And so my wife says, well, why don't you start writing your book, write a book about it? And I said, I've never wrote a book. My grammar is terrible. You know, I don't even know what an adjective and a pronoun and a verb are, you know? And she goes, well, just start off from the very beginning, from the first place you went and each base that you traveled to, and just write all the stories down from each one of those bases and those locations, which I probably went to 30 or 40 different bases over there. I lived on probably 15 or more. You know, some of the bases were big, like Bagram, where they had linen and forks and real stuff, to where I would be up on top of a mountain where, you know, we would have nothing but one meal, a hot meal a day, and maybe 25 soldiers sitting up there, you know, as an overlook. So it was the full extremes of those areas. So that was kind of like the experience I had over there with those type of things and all the different people that I was, you know, running around with over there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically you just started then just writing all of this down and creating the book, huh?
Right. And so I just went from base to base and wrote down all the stories that happened. Some, you know, are, you know, laughable and entertaining. And some of them are, unfortunately, you know, sad and, you know, where there was people killed. And then you begin to wonder, like you see in some of these different shows and people talking, why was that person just hit by a rocket where I was walking yesterday and killed, you know, and not me? You know, one day makes a difference, you know, on that. Just like going back to that decision to go out to Bagram on a Wednesday instead of a Tuesday and Thursday, all of a sudden I had the rude awakening, like people's lives depend upon the decision I make, you know? And that was a sobering thing to happen, to realize that if I made the wrong decision, then, you know, somebody could die. And one of the first missions I went out with a particular military group, I asked the sergeant there, I said, how long do I have at this site? And here's 20 guys standing all pointing in different directions with guns while old Mr. Rich is walking around with a tape measure and, you know, and a pencil and pad and paper making sketches of what we're going to build there. And he goes, Mr. Rich, we're here for you. You take as long as you need. And all of a sudden, it hit me.
Wow.
All these guys, 19, 20-year-olds, maybe 30-year-olds, are all putting their life at risk so I can do my job. And that was a really sobering awakening for me at that point in time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, upon like returning home after those 4 years, did you experience any type of like the PTSD symptoms?
Well, and you can see where the humor gets kind of dark after a while, but,
okay.
I came home the first time, I had that car bomb explosion, you know, and my wife said to me, she says, well, now that you're home, let's go to a movie and maybe you'd like to see this movie kind of about like where you're about what you're at over there. And I was still kind of like in a daze coming back.
Okay.
And I said, yeah, sure, sure. And she took me to Hurt Locker. And that was about these bomb techs in Iraq. And I sat in the theater, and when that first bomb went off, I don't remember much of the rest of the movie, literally. And she kept looking over at me, kind of saying, are you okay? You okay? And I hadn't told her about what happened over there at that point in time. And so, you know, I had that. And so, you have those kind of things, explosions, you know, different things like that.
Yep.
You kind of react to. One of the things, it's kind of another humorous thing, is when my bodyguards would move me around in a village or a different area, one of them would usually hook arms with me and move me around. And finally, one day, I couldn't take it anymore. And I finally just said, Robbie, I said, would you quit pushing me around? Why are you doing that? And he goes, well, Mr. Rich, it makes it harder for the snipers to hit you. And so when I came home, and it's still to this day, I have a tendency, if I'm talking to somebody, if I was sitting here talking to you right now, I have a tendency to kind of weave, you know, and kind of not stand still.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of you got entrenched with those type of things. Unconsciously, I don't sit by a window anymore. Typically, you know, I'll sit back with my back to a wall. Just things that I was entrenched to know over there. And I guess you have to kind of maybe unlearn them again. And when my wife asked me about, what are you doing? I said, well, it makes it harder for snipers. And she goes, we have no snipers here. Would you knock it off? And so, Yeah, there was those kind of incidents. The one thing that I do have to say is, since I have the boys that were in the military, and I never served, I was in college during Vietnam, is that I now have an idea of what the deployments and stuff are at. So when my boys, one boy went to Iraq and the other one went to some other places, we could sit down and talk about, you know, what it's like to be on a deployment and what it's like to, you know, live in a crappy environment and the different things that, you know, they're exposed to. So if I hadn't had that experience, I'd never be able to say, hey, I kind of lived it, done that. I just say, well, you know, I kind of understand. But people that haven't been in that situation really don't understand. You know, they'd like to, you know, empathize with you, but, you know, you have to actually live through it to actually see, you know, what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Rich, please tell me and my audience, where can we find your book? What is the name of your book? Where's the best place for us to find it at?
Okay. The name of my book is One Brick at a Time. And you can go to my website. It's called One Brick at a Time Press, PRESS.com. And on there, if you want an autograph copy, you can order it through my website there, and I'll send you an autograph copy to you. Or down at the bottom, there's Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you can order through them too. But I can't autograph a book if you wanted somebody's name put on it, you know, through those outlets.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, Rich, this has been really just eye-opening. And, you know, I mean, I just have to say, I mean, it's so interesting. Yet at the same point in time, I look at this story, you know, that you've lived. And I think to myself, like, what a kind of eye-opening, you know, look on life of us, you know, here in America versus, you know, just on, you know, in another country, how vastly different the world can be. And I feel like this conversation with you is just a really just kind of, as I said, eye-opening realization of the differences that, you know, the world has in it. And yet there's these little common things like humor and, you know, different gestures that, you know, can still bond us all together and kind of creating this, you know, a little bit more, you know, more meaningful, you know, like reason behind this whole conversation today. So I thank you for sharing it with me.
Oh, you bet. And I think, you know what, one of the biggest takeaways is, you know, that I learned so much being over there. I was welcomed with open arms by the people over there. And so it was, I think, really interesting to be able to see it from, I guess you want to call it a non-militaristic type of agenda. And I went over there with no agenda. I was just over there to build stuff, you know, and each one of these stories and experiences just evolved into something that, you know, I could forever, you know, take with me and build upon. One of the things that it did do for me was when I came back, I now substitute teach, and I actually do it full time. And I actually go by Mr. Rich. I go mostly in the middle school and the high school, but the kids get a kick out of it. And so they, you know, are you rich, Mr. Rich? And the same question I would get in Afghanistan. And I try to relate. Yeah. I try to relate, you know, what it was like, what the people were there, you know, the hardships that the women and girls have to go through trying to get an education, if they can even get one. And so I think it's given me kind of a mission to kind of go out and explain to, you know, all the different students, you know, what different parts of the world are like, what their cultures are like, what being in business is like. So it's kind of given me a whole new career path at 70 years old. Everybody's saying, why are you doing this? Why aren't you out playing golf or doing something else? And I just said, well, this is something I feel I need to do to try to explain to, you know, the up and coming students, you know, what's out there and what to expect. And people in a lot of cases are no different than what we are here.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Rich, you are one incredible guy. And I must say, those students are very lucky to have Mr. Rich show up in class one day as the substitute. That's just really awesome. I love your spirit about you. And goodness, like I said, it's just been such a pleasure to talk with you today, hear your story. And I'm just totally just inspired and just so happy that, you know, here you are, you're taking what, the, you know, you learned from that experience and putting it forward, especially now to kids at schools. I just think that's really awesome. And again, you know, thank you for taking the time out of your day to be on the podcast.
Oh, I appreciate it. I appreciate you taking the time to interview me and be able to kind of get the message out there about my book. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And for anyone interested in Rich's book, please know that all links and information are in the episode show notes. So you have easy access to that. And so I encourage you to definitely go ahead and get a copy of Rich's book for yourself. Before I end, I just want to thank you for listening to another amazing conversation had here on the podcast. Wow. I don't know. Just such insightful information that Rich had to share with us about Afghanistan and really about life and helping us to look at life from a different view. And, you know, that's what this podcast is all about. So until next time, I hope that you get out there and look at life from a different view, wherever in the world you are. And until next time, just keep living and enjoying life like it was meant to be. Hey, real quick before you go, I have one last thought to leave you with. I, of course, hope that you've enjoyed today's episode, but more importantly, I want to remind you that I never want you to listen to an episode of this podcast to hear something that I have to say or that my guest has to share and think, wow, I wish I could be like them. I wish I could overcome my own challenges and do the great things that they are doing, but I just can't. Well, friend, that's where you are wrong. You are capable. You are able. And you darn sure are deserving of having all that you can imagine in this life. There's nothing special about me or any guest I have on this podcast. We are all just normal people trying to make it in this life. And so I encourage you to take a look at yourself in the mirror and remind yourself that, you know what? I can do it too. Now, of course, if you would like help along that way, reach out to me, whether that's as a listener of this podcast, a friend, or if you'd like to work with me as a coach. My contact information is inside of every episode's show notes, just like this one. So go down, check out my contact information, and reach out to me today. With that said, I encourage you to take on the day every day with grit, grace, and inspiration.